Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Glen Canyon Exposed Now and Then is a photographic and film exhibit by artists Don Kish and Tad Nichols. This unique showcase presents two perspectives of Glen Canyon: Nichols' iconic 1950s images, captured before the construction of Glen Canyon Dam, and Kish's contemporary photographs and documentary film, chronicling the canyon's reemergence as the water levels recede. That exhibit is at the John Wesley Powell River History Museum right now in Green River, runs until next year. So today we're going to talk with the co-curators of the exhibit, photographer Don Kish. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on. And printmaker Richard Jackson is joining us as well. Richard, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, let me start with Don Kish. How did you encounter the photographs of Tad Nichols?
Let's see. In 2000, I got a book, his book, Glen Canyon: Images of a Lost World. It was all his photographs that he had taken. Well, not all of his photographs, but, you know, definitely the selects. And this book was just like, it blew my mind. I was like, wow, this got buried alive. Like, it was so gorgeous. And I never saw Glen Canyon, you know, except for in books and, you know, through songs and writing. And so in my lifetime, I never saw anything so beautiful. And so when I saw his photographs in this book, it was very inspiring. You know, when I first saw it, I was like, wow, this guy's like the Ansel Adams of Glen Canyon. And I have had that book forever. And I never thought I would ever see Glen Canyon return. But that book was just inspiring. And that's like my first glimpse of what his work was like. But this book actually was printed by Richard Jackson, which
mm-hmm.
is here.
Yeah. So Richard, you actually obviously knew Tad Nichols. Tell me about him.
I did know Tad. I met him in 1994, actually on a river trip in Grand Canyon. He was part of a group of people who were river runners in Grand Canyon before the dam was put in place. And the USGS office in Tucson and the Glen Canyon Environmental Studies co-sponsored this trip of people who ran the river before the dam to learn from them visually and by video interviews during that trip, what changes they noticed from before the dam was in place and then after the dam was in place. And that's how I met Tad. And from that trip, we became friends. And we used to hang out together and have a lot of shop talk and enjoyed that. And one day I got a phone call from a friend of Tad's, also a friend of mine, a woman by the name of Diane Sawyer, who was a historian at the NAU Special Collections and Archives, and she knew Tad and Tad's family. And so her, along with the book designer and I, set Tad down because Diane felt that now was the time to get this book done, because Tad had been putting it off for 20 or 30 years. And so she took the bull by the horns and convinced him that we would help him produce this book, which he agreed to. And that's the book that Dawn saw when she first saw pictures of Glen Canyon. And that book came out in 1999.
Mm-hmm. I think he died the next year.
He did.
Yeah. Yeah. So extra poignance there, right?
Yes, exactly.
So let me start with Don. Yeah, go ahead, Richard. Yeah.
One other piece. During the time we were working, we actually worked together in the darkroom making prints for the book. And I would visit him in Tucson on a regular basis. And one day he gave me one of the cameras he used while when he photographed in Glen Canyon. And eventually Don heard about that, which he'll explain.
Pick it up there, Don. This must have been very, and I guess the seed of an idea, I can use Tad's actual camera and I can go back and photograph these areas that are now reemerging.
Exactly. But it was so interesting because, you know, Richard and I have been working together, photo geeking for a long time, for years. And so we've been working on other projects. And one of the projects I was working on was about a large format camera. But that project kind of fell through because of COVID. But while we were working on that, he goes, well, if you don't want to use the 8x10 camera, how about this 4x5? And when he showed me this 4x5 crown, the Crown Graphic camera, and I was like, oh, this is such a beautiful camera. This is nice, but I don't know if I'm going to use this right now. He goes, well, you can borrow it if you want. And I was like, all right, cool. Anytime. I was like, where'd you get this? He goes, this is Tad Nichols. I was like, this is Tad Nichols, the guy that documented Glen Canyon before the dam. You know, I was just in shock. And I go, this should be in a museum or something, right? Like, how did you get this? And then so he tells the story about, you know, meeting Tad, and then he was his printer and friend. So a couple years actually go by, and then the lake levels went down so drastically low, and I was like, wow, I want to go back and document Glen Canyon. And I was just thinking with my 35 millimeter, and then all of a sudden, like 2 o'clock in the morning, I just went, bing, I'm going to call Richard and get the camera and go back with the camera. Mm-hmm. And we did. And together, actually, our first trip was for Arizona Highways Magazine. We convinced those guys to send us out on an assignment and document, well, not really document the place. It would just go there with the camera and create and see what we found.
Was it your idea to exactly replicate, go to the exact places where Tad was? And because you had his camera, I guess.
Right. And no, we did that a little bit. We had some hot spots that we went to that were pretty iconic, and did some photographs of where he was at, and we would take his book and we would open his book and then take a picture of what was there, and then what Tad had done. But that I didn't do that with a 4x5. A lot of the places still are underwater. You know, it is still a giant lake. It is not, the river has not really returned. The little tiny glimpses that I've seen come out is just spectacular. I'm just shocked how beautiful that canyon is. So I just went there with a creative eye. And sometimes I use my 35, sometimes I use the 4x5. It just depended on the scenario, what the best shot would be. Tad was also very prolific on any type of camera as well. He did 35, 4x5, 6x6, 2x3. I mean, he had all kinds of cameras, and then he also did his silent film as well. So he was just well-rounded photographer. He could just do anything, and also a filmmaker. And so, yeah, that really, I think, too, was our connection, because I do all that stuff too. I just just want to go out there and create. So the exhibit actually has his film as well as my film in it too.
So his photographs, your photographs, his film, your film. Yeah. Wonderful symmetry there. Richard Jackson, you said you actually went to the darkroom with Tad, right? Is that a usual thing when you're doing prints for a photographer?
Actually, that's the best way to work with a photographer, I believe, in a collaborative style, because they know, photographers already know what their print should look like before I even start working with them. It's my idea to dig into their mind, so to speak, with questions about their intentions and their thoughts about why they made the photograph that they made when they made it, to learn more about each image so I can help myself see with their mind's eye and help create the print that they intended to make for themselves. Mm-hmm. So yeah, having photographers in the darkroom are now working with photographers in a digital way, making prints, same thing applies. Having a collaborative working style is the best way forward, I believe.
So I want to ask both you and Don pause here to talk about the art of printmaking. To a layperson and totally uneducated person like myself, I'll stand in for the audience here. You know, a photo is a photo. You, so tell me about the art of printmaking. What are the choices that you make?
Well, there's a lot of choices today, even more so than when it was just darkroom paper. But paper, whether it's darkroom paper or paper used for making prints with a digital device, have some of the same characteristics. Film and digital sensors can create a lot of different brightness ranges, always, at least most of the time, greater than what a piece of paper can present. So say an f-stop and scene brightness range terms, a digital sensor might be able to capture 14 f-stops if that's a big wide scene brightness range. But paper can only present maybe 8 of those. So we have to find a way to squeeze a bigger brightness range into a smaller one and have it feel like it's still the same image you would see if you were standing there looking at the scene. And then creating it in a more three-dimensional way. It's a very nuanced process so that if it's done right, people are actually stopped by and drawn into the image rather than just walk past it and say, oh, that's a nice picture. Mm. They're really drawn into the image if it's printed correctly. Mm.
So Don Kitsch, a similar question from the photographer's point of view, what goes into making a great print of your photo?
Yeah. I mean, you want to stop people in their tracks for sure. That's a huge goal. And then you also want the work to be consistent. You know, you want it to all kind of have a story, you know, it's all a similar story. So tones and subtleties of light and dark are also, and then this whole exhibit is black and white. I have one color photo, but that's just for a map, but I really love black and white. It just kind of takes you to another world, like another, yeah, black and white just brings you to a whole nother place. So just more, I don't know, mysterious and you know, I see in color, so black and white just kind of gives you just the lights and the darks and then so dynamic, you know, in that way. So yeah, you just, when you're making prints, you just want kind of to take people away and bring them into another place. Mm. You know, really get them to get kind of sucked into that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. Richard Jackson, what do you work mostly in black and white, or there's
mostly
a different...
actually mostly in color.
Mostly in color. Uh-huh.
I started in black and white and I love printing in black and white, but the demands of my job over the last 40 years has been mostly in color, working for a lot of photographers who work in color. So I've made a lot of exhibits for various museums and organizations around the country. And most of it has been in color.
Mm-hmm. And so as Don was saying, they're different, I guess, different moods, different ways of portraying things, black and white versus color.
Absolutely. And black and white is I enjoy black and white because when I see a black and white print, I see it. I think of it as a color image. If it's printed correctly, you can actually, I feel like you can see the color that was there, even though it's a black and white print. It's just how it's photographed and then how it's printed and presented gives it that ability, at least in my mind.
Interesting. And we will get back talking about Glen Canyon. I'm fascinated, though, about the art here. So before we go to break and come back, talk about Glen Canyon. Don Kish, I want to talk about, we've been talking about the art of printmaking. I want to talk about the art of photography a little bit here. You said something interesting on your website, by the way, donkish.com. You talk about your love for rivers, right? Running rivers. You find your heart and soul there. And then you connect that to photography. I'll quote you. You say, "The river helps me gain a knowledge of time and light." It's fascinating to me. Talk about the choices you make as a photographer.
Yeah, the river kind of just teaches you, to go with the flow. And photography is kind of the same way. You have to go especially if in landscape photography, specifically, is that you have to go with the weather, right? And Mother Nature. So that time is very valuable when things are happening and light is changing. So the same when you're running the river, you have to go with the flow of the river and create certain images by waiting for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not everything's instant gratification when you're out there. And in fact, sometimes you're just like hunkering down in a hole because you're like getting pelted by wind and rain or whatever. So there's all those aspects of creating amazing images is to being out there in those elements.
And I was watching a little video you made where you were doing photos of rock climbers. So sometimes as a photographer, you're dangling off the edge of a cliff, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So my work is adventure, art, and advocacy together. I do a lot of, I've been working as a, outdoor adventure hog photographer for a very, very, very long time. And then now I'm combining my art with advocacy work now as well.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk.
I feel like it's the best of both mm-hmm. worlds.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that advocacy, art as advocacy, right? Richard Jackson, before we go to break, I wanted to ask you about this art of making a good photograph, right? What are some of the choices that a good photographer has to make?
Photographers have to be both artists and technicians to make it work. And they have to be willing to wait for the right moment regarding the lighting, or the photograph doesn't work as well. So because a photographic print is in two dimensions, but what they're photographing is in three dimensions, they have to be able to learn how to translate a three-dimensional scene into a two-dimensional print and still have the print look three-dimensional. And that's an art in and of itself, and a knowledge of the technical side, knowing how to capture that scene when they see it and be ready for it technically as well as artistically.
Mm-hmm.
And I know of a lot of photographers who back in the day when they were packing in 40 or 50 pounds of equipment to the same site over and over again until they were there at the right time of light and the right image appeared, then they were able to make that image with their technical skills and capture it for people to see and enjoy.
Mm.
That's why my back is so bad.
Yes. Yeah, that's technology has helped us a little bit over the years in that respect, hasn't it? Well, we're talking about, we'll get back talking about Glen Canyon Exposed Now and Then. It's a photographic and film exhibit by artist Don Kish and Tad Nichols. And that's at the John Wesley Powell River History Museum in Green River. It is there now. It'll be there till next year. We're talking with co-curators of the exhibit, Don Kish and printmaker Richard Jackson. We'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. There's an exhibit at the John Wesley Powell River History Museum in Green River. That's there now. It'll be there till next year. It's called Glen Canyon Exposed, Now and Then. And this unique showcase presents two perspectives of Glen Canyon. Tad Nichols' iconic 1950s images before the Glen Canyon Dam went in, captured before that, and Don Kish's contemporary photographs and documentary film chronicling the canyon's reemergence as the water levels receded in the past couple of years due to the drought. So today we're talking with co-curators of the exhibit, Don Kish and printmaker Richard Jackson. So let me start with Richard Jackson on this. You helped Tad Nichols with his book, which was many years after these photographs were made, right? But I think he made these photographs knowing that these areas were doomed, right? He was documenting this before the dam went in. Tell me about I don't know if you had conversations with Tad Nichols about that, his feelings about these places.
Tad thought exploring Glen Canyon was important, and photographing it over the years, because he knew the dam was going in. He made a lot of river trips with two other people, a woman by the name of Katie Lee, and then also Frank Wright, another boatman and explorer. They traveled Glen Canyon, not always together, but reasonably often. It was the three of them, and they were known by a lot of the people as the We Three, and explorers of side canyons of Glen Canyon. In fact, many of the side canyons that they named, the USGS used those names on their topo maps because they were some of the first to really explore those side canyons. But Tad would talk about getting into Glen Canyon as often as he could every year for at least 15 years, even after the dam closed, to photograph the canyon and especially side canyons, because he knew that would be underwater at some point, and was hoping that that documentation would help either prevent other great places from being flooded or someday help restore Glen Canyon to what it is or what it was when he was there and photographed it before the dam. So I got a lot of stories about the different places he and his friends would explore. And the way we did this book was, I misspoke Diane's name earlier. It's Diane Boyer, not Diane Sawyer, I'm sorry. Diane Boyer, being a historian, put into chronological order all of his contact prints from 1950 by year through 1963. 63 was the year the dam closed. And we sat at Tad's dining room table in his home in Tucson, and he told his stories by reviewing all of these images that he photographed over those 13 years, as well as having diaries that went along with those photographs. So that became the content of the written part of the book. And then the photographs, of course, speak for themselves. In fact, the photographs, it could have been a 500-page book because he had so many great images. It was hard to cull it down to the ones that we actually used. But then I had the opportunity of printing those images with him. I would bring him into my darkroom and we would print them together. And then I got more stories. So hearing his perspective of Glen Canyon and how not only beautiful it was, but what a tragedy it was that it was buried under all that water, and felt that it was a big mistake that happened. Mm.
So Don Kish, you in the you never knew Tad Nichols, right? But in the film, you talked to him, right? You're expressing, hey, I hope I'm doing these images justice, and other sentiments. How did that come about?
I was carrying a journal. I usually journal about work and, you know, creative moments and things like that. And so I created a journal specifically for this project to put down ideas and, you know, or even, you know, camera, you know, technical stuff sometimes, or camps, or weather, you know, just all kinds of stuff I would be writing. And then when I started doing the film, I wanted to do something different, and I didn't know what it was, but I knew that I just didn't want like the same old kind of story. You know, went to this place and documented, and it was great. You know, I wanted something really heartfelt. So I started going back through my journals, and then I realized when I was writing, I was kind of writing to Tad, which is interesting. I wasn't writing to me. I was writing to Tad, and a lot of things kind of came out like that, and it felt very heartfelt. And so I feel like that's what I needed to finish this film. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you're obviously you're channeling a love for this place, right? And it's extra poignancy because it's a doomed place. Even the recent reemergence, some of that's been submerged again. So what if you talk a little bit about that? That gets us to advocacy, right? What you're hoping that people pay attention to this place, and what do you hope they do?
Right. So all those photos that I had taken are now underwater. You are correct. The water levels were dropping 2021, 22, 23. 23 was the lowest, and came back up in 24. We're not sure what's going to happen now in 25, but yeah, all the photographs that I took, except for Rainbow Bridge, went back underwater, which is kind of crazy to think about. But I feel with this work is the story I want to tell is like, let's not do this again. Like, you know, there's a tragedy to cover up such a beautiful canyon, which should have been saved as a national park for sure. Mm. Even David Brower, the CEO of the Sierra Club, excuse me, at that time, he said it was his biggest mistake to let Glen Canyon go under. So I guess my advocacy work is to show like the beauty and what was lost again and again. and then Tad was the same way. So that's our work is to document this beauty and to show everybody like this is what the tragedy is, the loss.
Richard Jackson, what do you think Tad Nichols' hope was? Obviously, as I said before, dam was being constructed as he was taking these photographs. I don't know if he talked about what he felt, you know, after this area was all submerged. The book came out after everything was submerged, right?
It did. The book came out in 1999. Of course, that was 30 years after Glen Canyon Dam closed its gates and the water started to back up into to fill what's now called Lake Powell. I didn't get the feeling that he felt like that in anyone's lifetime that he knew that Glen Canyon would reemerge. You know, I don't think he would. I think he would have been surprised at the 2023 low water. I mean, that was the same water level that was present in 1968 when the lake was filling. So that was extraordinary. Even though there's still a lot of water in the reservoir, it still, with that low of a water level, exposed a lot of areas that hadn't seen the light of day for, you know, almost 30 years. And what happened was a lot of the flora and fauna came back almost immediately, which was a surprise to a lot of scientists. They didn't think it would take, they thought it would take much longer for that to happen, but it happened really quite quickly. And I think Tad would have been exuberant over hearing that story, that when the water levels receded, what was lost reemerged pretty quickly. So I think he would have liked that.
Don Kish, you've talked about, I was reading another interview you gave, the fact that Glen Canyon's a large place. It's referred to sometimes as the Lost National Park. You know, certainly could have been under a different, you know, parallel universe or series of events. But you said what the photographs you took were not really photographs of Glen Canyon, but glimpses of the canyon. Tell me about some of those areas that Richard was referring to where the water level receded in certain places and the canyon immediately came back to life.
It was incredible to see, let's see, a side canyon. You know, you'd be going up and it's completely covered in mud and you can't go very far. And then to come back like a few weeks later after a flash flood, and then it just got scoured out and you could start walking up the side canyon again. So things are coming back fast. That sediment, there is this, you know, giant sediment bars that would just fill up these side canyons. And to watch them come back was amazing. And it was quick. Just a flash flood just kind of started it all. And then ones that were already kind of coming back, depending on which, you know, which side canyon you went to. But Richard's right. You go up into these side canyons and the plants and the trees are coming, all coming back, the willows, the cottonwoods, all the natural, flora and fauna would just start coming back. It was quite amazing, actually, how quickly things returned.
Yeah. You've done a couple of events with Zach Podmore, right? I think. And in this interview I was referring to, he said he's hopeful overall. I don't know if you're hopeful about the future. You know, the levels rise again and the canyons flooded again and they lower again. And, you know, it's kind of so it could be an emotional roller coaster, I imagine. What do you feel about the future of Glen Canyon?
It's a good question. It is a roller coaster. It was really hard to make the film. It's like, how do I make sense of trying to tell a story about this crazy landscape that keeps coming and going? And I am hopeful. I hope Mother Nature takes over, to be honest. I'd love to see Glen Canyon come back and and start thriving again, and that the dam is, you know, not working anymore anyway. It's kind of falling apart. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a very good place to put a reservoir anyway. I'm very hopeful, and I would love to see Glen Canyon come back in my lifetime. Absolutely.
Richard Jackson, same question to you. What are your hopes for Glen Canyon?
Well, I don't have any particular expectation of how or when Glen Canyon will come back, except that it will, because all dams are temporary. It's just a matter of how long they'll be in place. A man-made construction, something like a dam or a building or anything, they only last so long. And so at some point it will come back.
So Don, your film's called Tad's Emerging World, and you're going around giving what you call Tad Talks. That's very clever. What are you saying in your Tad Talks?
I just spread the Glen Canyon love. I just like, yeah, this is what I've been experiencing. And I just want to show the beauty so that people can understand what was covered up. And it's interesting, you know, a lot of people, well, young people. So I do a lot of universities and talks, and So a lot of students don't even hear about Glen Canyon, never even heard about Glen Canyon, but yes, they know about Lake Powell. So I get to teach them what Glen Canyon's all about through art. And, you know, they really connect like that. They can see it, and then they also get the feeling from the film about it. So yeah, it's a great connection to really teach people about this beautiful wild landscape.
Richard Jackson, your co-curator along with Don of this exhibit, what do you hope people take from this exhibit?
I think the beauty of both Tad's images and Don's images, that they take away the idea that there are places that should be protected, and with that in mind, what I will say is that if you go into this exhibit, what's one of the amazing things to me is that Don's images and Tad's images feel like they belong in the same family. They have the same feel. Part of that is, you know, Don's a great photographer too, and so is Tad. And by working with both Tad and Don together, I was able to make prints that felt like they belonged to one another, even though they're hanging in the same room, but they were photographed, 60, 70 years apart. So that was kind of incredible to see that. And other people who saw it, who hadn't seen the photographs before, felt the same way, and that was rewarding.
Before we leave this, and in the next segment, brief segment at the end, I want to get into some interesting other things in your bios. Don Kish, you mentioned you read from Katie Lee's journals on this, referenced Frank Wright. Let's talk about Katie Lee, for example. Just a force of nature, right? Lived almost 100 years. Singer, activist. What do you take from Katie Lee?
Oh man, that woman is a force. Yeah, a force of nature for sure. She is just, yeah, a very huge inspiration for me, as well as Tad, but also Frank Wright too. Actually, all three of them, giant inspiration. You know, I'm a photographer like Tad. I'm a musician like Katie Lee. A boatman like Frank Wright. So I feel like I have a little bit of all of them inside me to keep this story going about their love for Glen Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it and I feel it when I'm there. And so you talked about channeling Tad when I was down there and talking to him and then writing to him those letters. I wrote a song that was totally inspired by Katie Lee when I was down there. Absolutely. I go back with a boat that is very similar. It's a replica of the boats that used to be going down Glen Canyon back in the 30s, actually. I get a lot of nostalgia going on in this project, which is great.
Richard Jackson, anything you'd like to say about Katie Lee, Frank Wright, any of the other, you know, great river runners and activists?
I knew Katie Lee pretty well. I made a lot of prints for her as well. She was a photographer too. But I got to know Katie really well, and she was adamant about the mistake she feels was made by putting the dam to create Lake Powell. But she was she never waned in her belief that that was, and she always advocated for the change to remove the dam. Not that it happened in her lifetime, but there are still others carrying on her ideas that someday maybe the dam will be decommissioned. Of course, there are people. You know, it's a beautiful place. The lake is of course there, and a lot of people enjoy that large body of water. So there are others who feel differently about whether or not the dam should be there. But as I said before, I think everybody knows that at someday the dam won't be there anymore. It's already challenged by the drought and whether or not they can maintain enough water level to keep the generators generating power is always a question, or at least it has been in the last 2 or 3 years. So that's still to be decided as well. But one of the things that I remember about Tad and his thoughts about it is that his memories of the place are as strong as his photographs. And he lived within those memories and expressed his feelings about the place because he explored it so much for so long. And everybody kind of got it when they're around Tad, what a place it was for him and his two other companions and others who also explored Glen Canyon. So that's I was when we finished interviewing him for his book, I felt like I'd actually been on a river trip in Glen Canyon, and I'd never actually been there, of course, because the lake had been there ever since I had moved to Arizona. But if I actually felt like I'd been on a river trip with him through Glen Canyon.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we're talking with the co-curators of an exhibit called Glen Canyon Exposed Now and Then. We're talking to photographer Don Kish and printmaker Richard Jackson. We'll come back with a brief final segment following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about an exhibit, Glen Canyon Exposed Now and Then. That's at the John Wesley Powell River History Museum in Green River. They're now going to be there till next year. And we're talking with co-curators of the exhibit, photographer Don Kish and printmaker Richard Jackson. So just a brief segment here at the end. I want to get into a little bit of your bios here. Richard Jackson, I'll start with you. I'm reading an interview you gave that you were introduced to, I guess, the photography in the dark room in eighth grade. What was it that sparked your interest at that early age?
A friend of mine in eighth grade, who was very excited about photography, suggested I join him for some photographic explorations with him, and I got bitten by the bug and became interested in photography and became a photographer for several years before I stayed in the dark room. And so, yeah, eighth grade, I got my first camera, a Brownie Star Flash camera, a Kodak camera, which I still have. Sits on my knickknack shelf here in my camera collection. I always loved photography. I loved being in the dark room. And at some point, I decided being in the dark room was a more creative place for me than making photographs. Making photographs, it's a special talent, and I understand a lot of what photographers go through, having been a photographer, because when people ask me if I'm a photographer, I said, no, I'm a printmaker. But I understand photographers and what they go through to make the images they do, and I have a lot of respect for that. So I've learned how to ask questions, as I mentioned earlier, to find out what they're thinking and where their eyes go when they see an image and how they want an image to be printed by, again, asking more questions and finally gaining their perspective on what they expect the image to look like. So when I'm working with photographers in a collaborative way, and we're making prints, and we'll do test after test and make small changes to make sure that we get just the right image printed the way they wanted it, we have two outcomes only that can happen. Either the print is exactly what they expected, or it beats their expectations. If we haven't got one of those two answers to the print, then we just haven't got done. We haven't finished, is what I'm trying to say. So I really, and that way, when we finish a print, we can walk away from it and forget that image for now and walk and get to another one. If there's something hanging in the back of my mind, like I should have done this, or I should have tried that, I have to go back and try it and do it, because I won't be satisfied unless we try the what if. Because there's sometimes a what if you just have to. There's a what if you have to do it.
That's right.
Oh, he'll take a print and just rip it in half. Mm-hmm. You're like, whoa, what are you doing? You just ripped something. Like, it looks good. He's like, nope, not good enough.
You're like, well, if it doesn't work to satisfy the photographer's need, it shouldn't live in the world, is my mm-hmm. view. So,
oh, there you go. Yeah,
we just keep going until we get there.
Yeah. Well, Don Kish, just a couple of minutes left. I want to take you back to your beginnings as well. I understand, for reading from your website, your bio, that get your mom had a subscription to National Geographic. You had a whole library of those wonderful images. And then in your career, you've been able to be a photographer for National Geographic. But tell me about that initial interest, just about a minute left here.
Oh, yeah. I remember we had a bookcase of all, you know, just National Geographic's bookcase. And so I would be, looking at these, and I'm imagining that's definitely an inspiration for me at such a young age. You know, this is like 5 or 6 years old, where I'm like looking at these things. They were in my bedroom. I don't know if she put them in there to set the seed, or I don't know. I actually thought I was going to be a painter. I actually was doing a lot of like snowboard graphics and illustrations and things like that, and so I thought I was going to be totally some other career, but then photography just kind of all the planets were aligning for that, so I just kind of went on that direction, and it panned out really well. I get to travel and I get to learn from people in different cultures, and that's what I want to be doing. This is the love that I have, the love for the land and love for photography.
Well, we'll leave it there. Out of time. Much else we could say from your interesting biographies as well. Just mention here at the end that there's an exhibit. It's ongoing now at the John Wesley Powell River History Museum in Green River, running until next year. Glen Canyon Exposed, Now and Then. And we've been talking with the co-curators, photographer Don Kish and printmaker Richard Jackson. Don Kish, Richard Jackson, thank you so much for being on the program.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And invite everybody to come out and see the exhibit. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.